for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Britain has a new prime minister and an unlikely coalition government. Afghan President Hamid Karzai gets a warm reception in Washington after months of tension. And the Pope blames the sin inside the church for a sexual abuse crisis involving Catholic clergy in different countries. Joining us for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Yoki Driesen of The Wall Street Journal, Martin Walker of United Press International. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Twitter. Send us a message on Facebook. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yoki Driesen, what is going on in Thailand? Explain the political crisis there.
You're seeing the sort of bloody climax of basically a more than four-year-long struggle. In 2006, there was a coup against the previous prime minister, Thaksin Shinawatra. It took away his fortune. He'd made billions in telecommunications and other industries. He was very populist and was seen as a result as kind of a threat to the more established Thai political system. They arrested him, convicted him in absentia once he fled, took away most of his fortune and tried to kick him and his followers out of politics. He's proven himself to be fairly wily, however. He's moved from country to country, constantly beaming back over the internet exhortations to his followers who are, as we're seeing now on the streets of Bangkok, both numerous and committed to him and to what they perceive him having stood for. He now has become a symbol from outside of Thailand to what protesters want to see Thailand become, which it is not right now, a fairer country, one where the income disparity is less than it currently is, and one where their political system is not as sclerotic as it's been for the last few decades.
And this photograph on the front page of every newspaper, Karen DeYoung, a reporter, was talking to this major general, and all of a sudden a shot rings out, and he's shot right in the head.
Well, this was a Major General Katia, who is the one of the leaders of the protesters who call themselves the Red Shirts. This all started about 2 months ago when they came down. These are our lower economic groups, people mostly from the north, northwest Thailand, came down to protest in former Prime Minister Thaksin's name, started in the middle of Bangkok in a kind of central park in the main shopping area. They've been joined by many thousands more people, and various people have proclaimed themselves the leaders of the movement. He is one of them. He's a dissident army officer. He said that his followers would provide security for this gathering of people who are really encamped in the middle of Bangkok. Some of the protesters don't like him. Some of them don't follow him,
yeah.
But he's sort of self-proclaimed.
He is now in a coma, Martin.
Yes, I mean, he was shot presumably by a sniper. The authorities have denied, or the army have denied, having any responsibility in that. And he's now in a coma, and it's clear that the tensions are building up. We've had five dead in the last 24 hours.
What do the Red Shirts want now?
They want new elections, and they want Thaksin brought back, given a chance to come back to power and to reinstall the kind of populist measures that he was famous for and that he was popular for. But behind all that, one of the big issues is what on earth is going to happen to the Thai monarchy, because the current king is very old. He's seen as a linchpin of stability, traditionally widely respected, but he's also now seen as something of a symbol for the old guard, the old regime, which has been, I think, quite thoroughly discredited by the events in Thailand.
So what is the Thai government likely to do, Yogi?
You know, it's not clear if the past couple of days, and today in particular and yesterday, both of which were very bloody, are any indication the crackdown will intensify. There were reports earlier this morning of Thai troops closing in even more firmly around the camp, the sort of de facto informal camp that the Red Shirts have set up in downtown Bangkok. There are reports of them pouring gasoline onto the barricades surrounding the camp and saying, basically, either this stops or we'll potentially light these barricades on fire. There was more gunfire. There were troops both on foot and on vehicles moving through the city. So if the last couple days are an indication, this may get very, very significantly more violent than it already has become.
I think Martin made a good point about the monarchy. The king in Thailand has traditionally, through many, many decades of upheaval, and he has been king for many, many decades, has always stood above it all and has been the person who ultimately has been the symbol that calmed things down. That's not happening now. The government, when this first started 2 months ago, started negotiations. There have been periodic negotiations with the protesters. They've all completely broken down. And now it looks like the government, if you look at what's happening today, lots of violence, the government is going to move in and try to clear this out.
And the economic costs to this are humongous.
Well, it's certainly going to hit the tourist trade.
Exactly.
So far, the Thai economy has been recovering from the recession that hit the world in 2008, recovering almost as well as, say, Malaysia has. But this is certainly going to put a crimp in this. And it's clear matters are coming to a head because last week, the military authorities cut off the water, closed down all things like rubbish clearance and so on from this park where the protesters are gathered. And it's an open question how long they can stay there without water in this kind of temperature.
Yeah, okay.
They've also extended the state of emergency, which had been in a small portion of the country, to a significantly broader swath of the country, which was seen as somewhat of a preemptive move to prevent other protests from breaking out, but also to prevent people from flooding into Bangkok in the case of more violence. But we talk often on the show about political vacuums in different parts of the world, and I think Martin's point before is spot on, because what you're seeing here is in some ways a moral vacuum. I mean, the king was not, as he's aged and gotten more and more sick, he was not a political ruler in the sense of running the country on a day-to-day basis, but he was a moral authority. And as he is now physically not there, but also having somewhat been identified, as Martin pointed out, with the ruling elite, that there's this moral vacuum. What you're seeing as a result is a major general who even his own followers were a little bit uneasy about and saw him as somewhat extreme, who in his books has said that he stands outside the army and wants an open civil war, which is potentially not what a protest movement might want at its head, but also a government that shows every indication of being willing to use tremendous violence against its own people.
Yoki Driesna of the Wall Street Journal, Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post, Martin Walker of UPI. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Martin, Britain has a new prime minister and a deputy. What can you tell us about David Cameron?
Well, David Cameron, like Nick Clegg, the Liberal leader who is the Deputy Prime Minister, they're both fresh-faced, rather young men, family men, very appealing, each 43 years old, youngest Prime Minister for nearly 200 years. And there is an extraordinary buoyant mood of honeymoon in the media in Britain and I think in the public as well, that this is heralds some kind of end to the old divisive left-right politics, the prospect of a coalition that can tackle the grievous economic problems. But I don't think the honeymoon's going to last because there are severe differences between the two parties, Liberal Democrats and Conservatives.
But don't you see compromise in the works?
Well, that's what they're promising. That's what they're talking about. The reality that's looming is not just the severity of the economic recession, an 11% budget deficit and so on, which means some pretty savage cuts are coming in public spending. But we've got the first big confrontation and tussle coming next week, which is in Brussels, in Europe, where the French and the Germans, using their usual critiques of Anglo-Saxon capitalism, are trying to put through, well, rush to push through, some very draconian measures against hedge funds and private capital. Now, already the US Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, has written to Brussels saying this would be really very, very unfortunate and would be taken very seriously by the US. It would close down access to Europe for US hedge funds and other financiers. The British City of London is saying the same thing. The Conservatives love the idea of a confrontation with Europe, which they don't like. Nick Clegg is probably the most Europhile politician ever elected in Britain. He adores Europe. He used to be a European Member of Parliament. He used to work for one of the European Commissioners. And so in the very first week, we are going to get an issue which can drive a wedge directly between this honeymoon dream team of the new young coalition types.
Karen.
Well, I think Martin's right, and I think there are a number of other issues. You know, the Liberal Democrats have agreed to join the government in exchange for some alteration in the way elections are held or the way votes are counted in Britain. Traditionally, they get a lot of votes in very few seats, the Liberal Democrats, because of the way the system is set up. There are a number of other issues in which their campaign stands and their party platforms are almost diametrically opposed to each other. They have agreed that they will continue to beef up the National Health Service. The Liberal Democrats have pretty much dropped their demand that there be no nuclear power stations in Britain, which is something that is near and dear to the hearts of a lot of their followers. So you've got the two leaders and the people, the high people around them, saying, okay, we're ready to compromise, but we haven't seen what their constituents are interested in yet.
It's also interesting, you know, as an American looking at this from the outside, the incredible differences between right-left, as they're defined in England, and right-left as we would see them here. You know, for decades, Republicans loved Margaret Thatcher. She was sort of an icon on par with Reagan for American Republicans who saw real common ground with the Tories in England. But if you look at the platform of David Cameron and how he managed to have this victory, it was by being relatively pro-gay marriage, pro-environment, refusing to touch the National Health Service, taking positions that would be considered Democrat positions in the U.S. So if you have a Republican Party in this country being pulled more to the right, it's interesting that you're now seeing real daylight between parties that were once very close.
Yoki Driessen, he's military correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. When we come back, we'll talk about that European economic crisis. Take your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Martin Walker of UPI, Yoki Driessen of The Wall Street Journal. And we're going to fairly soon take your calls, your emails, your questions and comments. Yoki, the EU put together a nearly $1 trillion financial rescue package for its various ailing members, Greece being at the top. What does the package do?
Yeah, the package is meant to sort of backstop the possibility of other countries suffering quite the sort of complete loss in international confidence in their financial system and their bonds that Greece has suffered. It's meant to be a sort of moat of a sort around Spain, around Ireland, around Greece, you know, around this really unfortunately named PIGS acronym that's being used very widely now without any sense of irony by those who use it. What these require is austerity measures of a sort that developing countries almost never usually lecture developing countries to impose, but very rarely do you see them imposed in the developed world. You're seeing pension cuts, spending cuts, tax increases, retirement ages going up, the social safety net being cut by large percentages, 12%, 9%, 5%. And in all the countries that have imposed them, it's seen that that's a first step, not a last step. So you're seeing a sort of fundamental change in the European social safety net, but also a sort of fundamental loss of sovereignty of a sort. I mean, these are developed, standard, strong countries, and what they're saying is we need so much help from the EU, from the IMF, from other countries and organizations, that we will cede sovereignty over parts of the way we run our country to those organizations.
Mark?
One of the really striking things about what happened over the weekend when the European leaders put this together was the role of the US administration. President Obama personally telephoned Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, Nicolas Sarkozy, the French President. Tim Geithner was on the phone. The Fed was involved with the European Central Bank. And it was Obama who stressed they had to go a great deal further than the original $100 billion package that was being talked of, and made it clear that the US would stand with them, that the US would support a 250 billion euro loan through the IMF, which the US will be part of, and that the Federal Reserve has also given what looks like a pretty open-ended commitment of currency swaps between dollar and euro. So the US really played, I think, a pretty critical role in this. The difficulty is the intent of this huge package was to impose a kind of shock and awe upon the markets, to make the speculators think, oh my God, we'd better pull back and not try and sell short the euro anymore. And it hasn't really worked. The standing of the euro against the dollar has come down to the same level it was before the crisis. What's really worrying is that the LIBOR rate, that's the London interbank overnight rate, has started to widen. This is the rate at which banks will lend money to one another. And when that rate goes up, it means banks don't trust one another to survive beyond 24 hours.
And that's what happened here in the United
States.
That's
exactly what happened worldwide in 2008. And it's now happening. When we get to a 50 basic points LIBOR spread, then we're in trouble, and we're very, very close to that. So this isn't over. The riots are still going on in Greece. We've still got more cuts, as Yuki said, to come. The Spaniards have announced pay cuts of 5% for all civil servants. The British cabinet, their first decision was 5% pay cuts for themselves. That almost certainly heralds 5% pay cuts coming for British civil servants. We've had 12% cuts in Greece of people on the public dole. We've got 9% in Portugal. It's going to go on like this. It's not just in Europe that the welfare state is unaffordable. When Yuki made the point about increasing retirement ages, this is coming here too.
Of course.
And to the point before about how this, A, is not over, and B, it's not necessarily working, there is still, and you could see this in the sort of prices of Greek-issued bonds and other securities, but there is no confidence at all that Greece will be able to stave off a sovereign debt default on its bonds. I mean, the point of this in part was to try to shore up Greece's standing specifically. And your investors are not, as of yet, signaling that they buy that it'll be enough to do so.
Well, they bought time, because what this package means is that the Greeks do not have to go to the markets to raise the 18, 20 billion they've got to borrow over the course of the next 2 to 3 months. They will be able to roll over for a year or so the bonds that they've got. But by then, the problem will be worse. So I think that you're absolutely right. I think that we are going to see an orderly default, i.e. a rescheduling, but there'll be some pretty big losses to take, particularly by the European Central Bank. One thing that the Bank of England did when it went into quantitative easing, that is buying up bonds to keep the market afloat, was that it only bought the really top-rated bond, whereas the European Central Bank is now buying something pretty close to toilet paper and is calling it good collateral.
Let's move on to Afghanistan. Karen, tell us about Afghan President Hamid Karzai's visit this week. How well did it go?
I think from the Afghan point of view, it went very well. President Karzai came with several goals in mind. He wanted some very specific commitments on things like the United States turning over control of the Afghan prison system to him, which was supposed to happen by the end of this year, but the Americans have been dragging their feet for various reasons. He got a commitment to turn over the largest prison at Bagram Air Base by January. He got approval of his peace plan draft, which he brought with him. He got more commitments about civilian casualties, restriction on what they call night raids. That's U.S. and coalition troops going into villages at night, banging on doors, looking for Taliban and other insurgents. He got a promise to negotiate by the end of this year what's called a strategic partnership agreement, which is the kind of thing that the Bush administration negotiated with Iraq, which commits the United States to a very long-term relationship with Afghanistan, not necessarily with combat troops, but certainly for security and training, and more importantly, from the Afghan point of view, for development assistance, diplomatic assistance, and the kind of long-term partnership that Karzai can now take back and say that he has achieved. I think from the American point of view, what they got was a lowering of the temperature at a time when they're trying to get a pretty big supplemental appropriation passed for the war, when they want to build confidence in the Congress and the American public that things are going according to plan. So what they got was, after months of turmoil and reports that Obama and Karzai didn't like each other, that Karzai was going in a different direction, they got everybody coming together in Washington and putting their arms around each other and saying, we're friends, and yes, our relationship will have ups and downs, but basically we have the same strategic goal.
What about Karzai's relationship with his own brother and how that was talked about? Why was it talked about, Yogi?
It's half-brother, actually. Ahmad Wali Karzai is the provincial council head in Kandahar province, but that title is sort of irrelevant to A, how wealthy he is, and B, how powerful he is. He's thought to have made his money through opium. If you talk to U.S. military and U.S. intelligence people, you get very different views about whether there's actual evidence to suggest he's corrupt or whether it's just sort of rumor. He has been a CIA asset for many, many years. The U.S. military has used him as an asset as well because of his reach and his influence in Kandahar. But if part of the goal of this upcoming Kandahar operation is to strengthen the Kandahar government, which is very, very weak, you want to strengthen the formal Kandahar government, which is a governor named Vesa, who's sort of irrelevant right now, but the goal would be for him to be relevant when this is finished. You can't do that if you have a rich, potentially corrupt guy with a direct line to the president who has his own power structure within the province.
Now, considering, as Karen outlined, that Karzai got pretty much everything he wanted, was it a mistake for the U.S. to be publicly criticizing Karzai, Martin?
Well, I think it was a mistake, but I think it was made worse by the way some documents were leaked from the U.S. ambassador to Kabul, who just simply said that Karzai was not a credible partner in the alliance. That was at the beginning of the year, and that, I think, made things a great deal more difficult. The fact is that the grand strategy put forward by General McChrystal, which is the kind of the drop of oil strategy based upon what the French were doing in Morocco under Marshal Lyoté, is to try and hold an area and build up a kind of a local effective civil government there, and then for that patch of oil to spread. That was what the Marjah offensive was meant to establish in Marjah, and it was then meant to spread to the Kandahar operation. Difficulty is, in Marjah it didn't really work. The military part went fine. They were not then able to bring in the government in a box to take over and to deliver stability and more prosperity in Marjah, because the Afghan government didn't have the capacity to do it. And that is the real difficulty here. There's another factor which has just started to emerge, which is the presence of a very dangerous, a very damaging fungus in the opium crop, which seems already to have cut the opium crop by about a quarter or a third. According to what I'm told by some of the military people that I've been asking about this, the word is going around Afghanistan that this was a fungus rather like Agent Orange, deliberately spread by the Americans. This is now denied by the military. What it means is that the world opium price is going up like a rocket, and the Taliban have got an awful lot of opium stored. So in other words, the Taliban's treasury to buy arms and so on is now very much larger than it was.
Karen, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think that obviously opium is a problem. It's a problem for the Afghan economy. It's a problem for the military action. It's a problem for the balance of power in Kandahar. But I think there are much larger problems. If you look at Kandahar, which is a place where there has always been tribal conflict, and the whole place is not in balance right now. Ahmad Wali Karzai has built his fortune largely by controlling the political process there and putting members of his tribe and the president's tribe in power. What the coalition wants to do when they go in there, as much as kinetic military operations, is to try to change that balance of power and give other people, who in fact are the majority in Kandahar, an interest an economic interest, a governance interest in what happens there. And I think that's going to be the really, really hard part, because the Americans don't really understand the dynamic of Afghan political society. And on the other side, fighting against them are Karzai and people who are very entrenched and who don't want that balance to change.
Yeah, okay.
You know, in the previous administration, one of the biggest critiques lobbed against the Bush White House was that they were out of touch, especially on Iraq, that they were constantly saying there's progress,
right,
long after there was no progress, and wouldn't refuse to acknowledge that the situation was very dire. What was very striking to me this week, I'm going to be leaving for Afghanistan in about 2 weeks to cover this, for about a month to cover this Kandahar operation. So I've been interviewing a lot of people there in particular about what they're seeing in Helmand and in Kandahar. And the gap between what is being said in official Washington during this visit, where General McChrystal is fairly optimistic, Karzai is optimistic, the White House is optimistic, Hillary is optimistic publicly, but the gap between what they're saying and what you're hearing from military personnel on the ground across Afghanistan is really staggering to me. And frankly, it's the widest that I've seen it since Iraq, where you have military officials saying pretty openly, it's not working. Civilian casualties have gone down, but we're taking tremendous casualties as a result. Marja, money is not being spent. There are beheadings and assassinations throughout the city. Kandahar, there have been assassinations and beheadings. In the east, where we've sort of taken our attention away because of the focus on the south, the infiltration from Pakistan has risen again after months of being relatively quiet. There are attacks in Kunduz and parts of the country that were relatively stable even 3-6 months ago. It's depressing to see, actually.
This is entirely right. I mean, I get exactly the same stuff from the British military. And the new British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has just flown in to Washington to see Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, and to see Karzai. The British are going to stay involved, but there is growing concern in Britain about the way this is being handled.
Yogi Driessen and Martin Walker and Karen DeYoung, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about the new statements from the Pope on sexual abuse. He said the sin inside the church.
Yeah.
That's really the first time he said that, Martin.
It is the first time he said it, and what was really, I think, striking was where he said it. He went to Fatima, the shrine in Portugal, which was particularly close to the last pope. Indeed, the thing about this particular shrine is that the bullet that hit the last pope in the assassination attempt is actually now stored in the crown of the Virgin, the statue of the Virgin of Fatima. And the current pope said, in praying to the Virgin, quote, "It's a profound consolation to know you are crowned not only with the silver and gold of our joys and hopes, but also with this bullet of our anxieties and sufferings." He said that the abuse in the church had been truly terrifying, that forgiveness was no substitute for justice. It's been the strongest statement the Pope has made. At the same time, some of his supporters are saying that he has been taking many more striking actions against the defenders of the abusers in the church than had been publicly known so far, including against a cardinal who was a previous Secretary of State who was trying to, as it were, keep the lid on the scandal. And the person, the cardinal, who's been most outspoken of all is somebody who's seen as a likely successor to this pope, to Pope Benedict, and that's the current Archbishop of Vienna.
You know, I think, though, that there's a real disconnect in terms of both perceptions and sense of how to proceed between the Vatican and the Pope, and both the accusers and the people who are outraged about this. The statement that the Pope made, I agree with you, is within the context of papal statements, a great move forward, and that's how the Vatican sees it. I think for the people on the other side, this growing conflict in many countries now spreading across Europe, it doesn't mean all that much. I think that the church is kind of fighting a battle that's lagging way behind where the battle actually is, and I think that it's going to be very difficult for them to catch up with it because they simply don't move that fast, and there's a point beyond which, at least from what we've seen so far, they're just not willing to go.
Yogi.
I agree with that. I mean, I think in this country you saw American Catholics who might still take their moral leadership in some sense from Rome, but their personal views on sexuality, on gays, on abortion, on divorce, on contraception were certainly not in line with what, you know, papal theology would say. what's been very striking to me, again, as an outsider to this, is watching what's happening in Ireland. I mean, when you think Catholic, often you think Irish Catholic, I mean, especially in the American context, and sort of the public agony you're seeing in Ireland of the Irish people saying, we've suffered tremendously. I mean, Irish, the abuse cases, they're coming out almost day by day in Ireland. It's staggering to watch the Irish of all countries say back to Rome and to this Pope, we have suffered tremendously. We, a flock in a country that has been so close to your church for so long, and you have handled this unfairly. I mean, so you're wondering, I wonder if you'll see, same way that the American Catholic community has kind of moved beyond Rome to a degree, but if the Irish Catholic community will do the same.
But it's, I mean, I think one of the things that the Vatican is focused on is that the future of the church is not going to be in Ireland. It's probably not in the USA. The future of the church is going to be in the developing world. There's going to be the majority of Catholics quite soon in Africa. And there you've had absolutely no concern of the kind we've seen in Germany, in Ireland, in North America. This is, if you like, a rich world Catholic problem.
Martin Walker of UPI. Short break, and when we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview about Lena Horne with her daughter, Gail Lumet Buckley. When her mother first signed with MGM, the studio wanted her to play a maid, but Horne and her father refused.
Teddy Horne the Gambler came out to Hollywood very dapper and demanded an interview very politely with Lubie Mayer and said, I can afford to hire a maid for my daughter. She doesn't need to play a maid.
Join us.
And it's time to open the phones for your calls, your comments. Let's go first to Reed in Havana, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I was calling because I heard on the radio this morning that President Karzai will visit Fort Campbell today to greet the 101st Airborne as they prepare to deploy to Afghanistan. I'm wondering how your panel thinks he will be received by the soldiers who are getting ready to deploy in light of some of the problems that the administration has had with President Karzai recently. And I'll take my response off.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Yoki?
Yeah, I was down at Fort Campbell about a week ago to talk to the 2nd Brigade Combat Team of the 101st. They're the ones who are leaving now as we speak to take part in Kandahar. And they're the ones who President Karzai will spend the most time with on that trip. To be honest, I think that the average soldier, if you have a visiting foreign leader, but for them even more directly, if you have Defense Secretary Gates, Admiral Mullen from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General McChrystal, who's kind of a rock star in the ranks of the Army, they will be so blown away at the level of kind of VIP-ness that's descending on their base. You're not going to have soldiers say to President Karzai, hey, Hamid, what about the corruption? It's a fair concern, and it's a question that they may be asking with their families or off the base, but if you have a big pomp and circumstance type event, which this will be, there won't be an opportunity to question him about politics and corruption and other causes.
During the break, you were talking about an event that happened at the White House this week.
The first public event this week on this trip was General McChrystal, Ambassador Eikenberry, who have been publicly and privately feuding for months, being brought to the White House with Robert Gibbs. They've been fighting about how many troops should go. They've been fighting about whether to set up local defense militias across the country. They've been fighting about Karzai. General McChrystal has a very close relationship with him. Ambassador Eikenberry does not. I mean, Eikenberry has been critical of him in cables. By all accounts, Karzai doesn't like him and doesn't want to talk to him and prefers to deal with McChrystal directly. And so they were brought to the White House alongside Robert Gibbs, the White House spokesman. And it was a very, very strange event. First off, it's strange to have a four-star general, an ambassador, and a White House political press secretary sharing a podium. It was supposed to be half an hour. It was significantly shorter because whenever there'd be a question that potentially was about Karzai or about the tension between Eikenberry and McChrystal, they would either dodge it or Robert Gibbs would step in to try to shut the questioning down. And it was just a very uncomfortable event, I think, for most reporters in the room. But within the Pentagon, where I spent a lot of my time, there was real kind of anger at the White House for this event. They thought it made McChrystal look bad and look political, frankly.
Now, how inside Washington is that, or how significant is that to what's happening in Afghanistan?
To what's happening in Afghanistan, not so significant, except that the sort of dysfunction you see on the civilian side in Afghanistan is very striking. President Karzai, whatever his flaws, does not deal with Ambassador Eikenberry. He doesn't like him, doesn't want to talk to him. He doesn't often deal with Ambassador Holbrooke, the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Irregardless of the blame there, that's not a functioning, sustainable system. Right now you have Karzai dealing almost exclusively with General McChrystal and shutting out the civilians, and that needs to change.
Wow.
I think it's interesting that you've seen part of the preparations leading up to the Kandahar operation has been a series of shuras, of conferences among local leaders in the Kandahar area, not only in the city but in the suburbs outside. And McChrystal has gone with Karzai and sat with him at a lot of these meetings. Eikenberry has not. What you saw in this, I agree with Yoki, somewhat strange appearance at the White House on Monday was McChrystal talking at some length about his relationship with President Karzai, how good it is, emphasizing, well, I relate to him as a military leader to a commander-in-chief. And then Eikenberry, who has sent these cables and has been privately very critical of Karzai, was asked, well, do you think he's an adequate leader? You said that you didn't in these cables. And Eikenberry very pointedly said, he is the president of the country. Our country has a relationship with him. And as the president of the country, I respect him. And there was a follow-up question, which Robert Gibbs cut off immediately and just ended the press conference.
Interesting. To Cincinnati, Ohio. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Diane. My question is one of perspective on the Catholic subsidies crisis. The Associated Press this morning is reporting that Bishop Nix's sexual abuse investigation in Germany has been dropped by the special prosecutor, citing a lack of evidence that a crime had been committed. And yet the Washington Post on October 21st, 2007, reported that 4.5 million American public school children will be the subject of abuse between kindergarten and 12th grade. We never hear about these things. We just hear about the assumption of guilt. So I'm curious how the panel would feel about the fact that Nix's investigation has been dropped and that the John Jay report found only about a third of sex abuse allegations made from 1950 to 2003 were substantiated. We'll hear a change about this in the media, and I'll take my response up.
All right, thanks.
Well, the caller is absolutely right. An awful lot of the allegations that have been made, some of them made through psychiatrists, psychologists claiming to be reviving submerged memories. A lot of these have not been substantiated by subsequent investigation, but an awful lot of them have been dropped for lack of evidence, and by the nature of these kinds of things, evidence can sometimes be pretty hard to come by,
yeah,
when it's the word of one person,
right,
against another. But when you get the church itself, or cardinals of the church, accusing fellow cardinals of deliberately blocking inquiries, when you get clear evidence of very high-level archbishops and bishops actually confessing that, yes, they had sinned in this way, then this is a cancer at the heart of the church.
All right, to Sylvania, Ohio. Good morning, Tony.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Diane, I beg to disagree with your guest, Yogi, about the opening statement about Thailand. You know, I spent the last 10 years going back and forth to Thailand, the last 5 years living there. This problem started more than 12 years ago. You know, Thaksin Shinawat, which is the former president, believed in trickle-down economy. But at the same time, yes, he was popular, and he was a populist president. However, he was scheming and taking a lot from the government, from the Thai system. Example, he sold many of Thai assets to the Singaporeans. This is what leads to his demise. And I think to hear an American talk about this in that respect, he needs to understand the complete system of Thailand.
Yeah, okay.
I would be the first to confess that I'm not an expert on Thailand, and I would defer to someone who's made as many trips as the caller indicates that he has made. I think that there doesn't necessarily have to be quite the binary that perhaps is being drawn. I think you can be populist and tied to a government. I think you can be wealthy and also be trying to contribute more money to the poor. He's a complex person. I mean, I think what we're seeing in terms of his ability to stay ahead of the Thai government as it's tried to muzzle him over the last 5 years is he's a very smart, wily, complex person who doesn't fall into the category neatly of just either naive political figure,
mm-mm,
or out-of-touch wealthy businessman.
All right, to Chester, Vermont. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Diane. Yesterday on NPR Radio at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Marco talked to the NPR correspondent in Afghanistan. She said that the Karzai government had gone to a village in northern Afghanistan to try to persuade the villagers not to grow opium, which grows at 20,000 an acre versus wheat at 1,000. They went along with it with the idea and the provision that they would get electricity, they would get all kinds of government services, and 6 months, 9 months later, no one has ever delivered anything. And this sounds like Vietnam, as a veteran, this sounds like Vietnam all over again. And I'd like to ask Mr. Walker, how long are the Brits, who really know the truth, what are they going to tell Obama about this?
Well, some years ago, I know that Prime Minister Tony Blair told President Bush that the smart thing to do in Afghanistan would be to buy up the entire opium crop, and either to burn it or to try and turn it into medicines. And Bush replied, "Don't you know we've got a war on drugs?" The real difficulty here is that we're trying to fight two kinds of wars at once. One against opium, which is critical to a great deal of the peasant economy in Afghanistan. And the second one, we're trying to fight a war against the Taliban. And as it's just been established in the last few minutes, the disconnect and the between reality and perception that the Obama administration is trying to convey this week is just extraordinary. There is no way that under current tactics and strategy, it seems to me, one can do anything more than fulfill what General McChrystal said to reporters yesterday when he said to us, "Well, at least I can say nobody's winning."
Wow.
I think that the caller has pointed up two of the major problems in the civilian side of this operation in Afghanistan. One is that the strategy now for dealing with opium is crop substitution to try and put in some other crop. For lots of reasons, this has not worked. Many, many other places that we've tried it. I remember being in Colombia almost 20 years ago and seeing them try to do that with the cocaine crop in southern Afghanistan. Big plans, big money, big American involvement. It just never happened. And the other is the difficulty of really bringing any of these civilian problems, civilian projects to fruition. They're pouring lots and lots and lots of money in there, and it's just not happening. They don't have the people, they don't have the infrastructure, and they're trying to fight a war at the same time.
All right, here's a message from Facebook from Emily. She says, as a 19-year expat, I'm really excited about this coalition government. I wish it great success, so it might set a standard for other bipartisan government bodies to model.
Well, yes, I'm excited too. Quite naturally, I am. I mean, this is one of the most sort of hopeful developments that I've seen in the old country for many years. But bear in mind, it's not as new as all that. If you count up the number of coalitions and of government and of different parties supporting one another in government in Britain over the last century, 39 of the last 100 years, we had one form or another of coalition government. So it's not that new to the Brits. The thing is, when we had it, it was the First World War, the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Depression of the 1970s, it only happens when things get really, really bad. And it's when things get really bad, it gets very tough for politicians to deliver.
Well, let's just hope.
Fingers crossed, Diane.
Let's talk about what Attorney General Holder had to say about a Taliban connection to the attempted Times Square car bomb, Yoki.
What he's been saying over the last couple of days, what's been emerging as sort of the theme of a lot of the public comments by the administration and by law enforcement, is that the links between Faisal Shahzad and the Pakistani Taliban, the Tariqi Taliban, TTP as they're sort of acronymized in the military, may be stronger than had been first thought. If you think back to the attack, the initial claim of responsibility was widely dismissed and frankly kind of ridiculed. This group was seen as largely a Pakistani problem and was not thought to have the reach to the U.S., Then the thinking evolved to he was inspired by them in some way, but was kind of a lone wolf who built it himself and planned it himself, and that's why the bomb was so crude. And now it's evolved from that to he went there, he spent time perhaps learning bomb making, he may have received money from them, he may have received training from them. They may have been a much more active role in facilitating this attack than had been thought even a week ago.
Why is Republican Senator Kit Bond maintaining that he had not seen any evidence of a Pakistani Taliban connection?
The administration has been up on Capitol Hill briefing the intelligence committees, and after these briefings, Bond and a number of others came out and said, well, I don't get it. I didn't see the link. We've looked for, they keep saying there is other evidence, but no one seems to be able to say what that evidence is. What we think it is that they've made an arrest in Pakistan of one other person, we don't know who that is, who they believe led Faisal Shahzad to the Pakistani Taliban. But I think that there's still a lot of questions about whether this is something that is more convenient for the Pakistani government and the American government than it is firm evidence of an actual link.
And why isn't the Pakistani Taliban on the list of State Department terrorist organizations, Yoki?
It's a very good question. It's hard to imagine that they will stay off the list much longer, irrespective of what this investigation turns up.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Waterford, Michigan. Good morning, Bernard. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. The admission by the Pope of sins in the church is not good enough. The church must deal with it, and in order to deal with those sins, it has to change its form of governance to be open, transparent, and accountable to the people of God.
Well, hear, hear. From your mouth, sir, to God's ear. But whether it'll go by the Vatican is another and very difficult question. The Vatican is a vast institution which sits upon centuries of tradition. It's worse, it's more difficult to move than an ocean liner.
And to Elkhart, Indiana. Good morning, Doug.
Thank you. Very good show. Outstanding panelist. But I have to disagree with one comment, and this is getting back to the Vatican. There's a comment that the future of the church is based in Africa, or let's say Latin America, and I just can't understand that from the aspect that the funding of the church really, I would assume, comes from Europe and the United States, and that's where the money is generated. And not to lose attention to the United States or to Europe and focus on Africa, to me, is totally an online business where you would want to pay attention to your core business.
Martin, that was your comment.
Yes, it was my comment, and I stand by it. And what's interesting is what's going to happen to the Vatican finances, given the collapse in the tax receipts that German Catholics pay through their tax system to finance the church. That's the biggest single funding the Catholic Church has. And Catholics have been leaving the church and abrogating those tax agreements for months now.
Martin Walker of UPI, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Yoki Driesen of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all.
Thanks.
And I'll be off next week, first to go up to New York to receive the Peabody Award. Then I'm going to have a voice treatment, so I'll be off all next week. Hope to be back with you perhaps a week from Monday or Tuesday. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.